Hi, everybody. My name is Sybil Corbin, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Sybil.
I thought I was going to stand on a little box or something. Is there a little Coke case or something, maybe? I'm used to pop cases. Oh, thank you. Oh, that's a little pedestal. I didn't mean I had to have a pedestal. Well, I'm glad to be here. I'll tell you, I'm glad to be here. I had a rotten day. But when I got here and I saw Chuck, suddenly it turned into a good day. And I saw Elsa and it was even better, I tell you. It's so great to see the two of them. I wish we lived in Laguna. I'd be a pest. I don't get to see them as often as other people. We live so far away and I just love them to death. What a treat. What a treat for Clancy's 26th birthday to have them here. Total surprise to me, and I imagine to a lot of you. Great treat just to sit here and look at them. You know, I love this group. It's been said before here tonight, but I truly do. Everybody's so good. I mean, so friendly, and they kiss you and hug you and all the things that I need. If I don't get kissed and if I don't get hugged or people don't notice me, I retreat real quickly and bite my fingernails and get real timid. And that can happen. It's such a miracle to me to know that in Alcoholics Anonymous, people seem to like me and they love me and I love them back. And it's just the greatest thing in the world that ever happened to me. I couldn't have dreamed when I was in my teens and 20s and even in my early 30s when I didn't want to live and I was ashamed and full of remorse about the way I was living, because I had believed what Papa and Mama told me. We lived down in Texas when I was a little girl and they were very strict. And they seemed to think that little girls were made of sugar and spice and just everything nice. And when we moved out here to California when I was 13 and went to grammar school, Papa remained stern and wouldn't allow me to leave the house after school or go to a Saturday matinee with the kids, especially if there was a boy involved. And I would ask him about it, and he'd say, "Well, that's the way it is, and you can't do those things until you're 18. Or until you're married." And I defied him. I looked at him for the first time in my life, and I wasn't afraid of him. And I says, "All right, then, I'll get married." And I did. I was sneaking off, jumping through the window at night and meeting a neighbor kid two or three blocks away anyway. And he was crazy about me, and I was crazy about him. And Papa didn't know anything about it. So when he talked about getting married, why, that's what we did. And he was a good boy. Nothing at all the matter with him. But little did I know that within a very short few weeks that I'd be drinking. He took care of me. He'd take a drink, maybe, maybe not. But from the time I had my first drink, I wanted to see what it was like, and I drank the whole thing. They passed the bottle around, and I just drank it. The whole thing. Everybody was supposed to have a little of it, the kids that were there. And so they just hauled me home, and Mama had to put me to bed. And the shame and the remorse that I felt was just overpowering. I mean, to wake up in the morning hungover and throwing up and begging forgiveness and saying, "It'll never happen again. Please forgive me." I meant that. I meant it. I was working at the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company then on the graveyard shift. I had lied about my age and had gone to work early. I had left high school when I was about 15, going on 16 maybe. And I worked hard, and when the bottle was passed around there, and I drank it and got drunk and told them I wouldn't do it again, I meant it, but it kept happening, and I was always apologizing. Always, all my life when I was drinking, I was saying, "I won't do it again, please forgive me." I mean, to all my husbands. I didn't give my full title here tonight, but you know it well. It's Sybil Doris Adams Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis Corwin. And most of those husbands were alcoholics. We were drawn to each other and drank together. The first one was a fine young man, 18. He didn't. He took care of me. And we were married 3.5 years. But, and my conscience bothered me because that wasn't the way I was brought up. I didn't mean to go into a bar and stay there all day and not go home until it closed and get in fights in the bar and go home with black eyes. And I'd look in the mirror and I'd wonder, who clipped me? What did I say? What did I do? And I wouldn't know many times. And ordinarily, I would drink in a bar 2 or 3 blocks from the house. And many times, I wasn't able to walk home. I would fall home. I would run a little bit and fall a little bit and get up and run about 5 steps and fall down and crawl a little bit and get to my house. I had a real estate office there and crawl up those steps. And by that time, my nylons would be way down over my shoe tops dragging in the back. And then the explanations in the morning, forgive me, I'll never do it again. And it was just awful living like that. And it continued to be awful. Marriages and divorces didn't help at all. And finally, I met a man who came from an extremely good family. They were in Who's Who, and they were an army family. His grandfather was a general, General Barlow, who put in the boundary line between Texas and Mexico. And his mother was a sweet, gentle saint, and his aunt was the same. And they were a fine family. By this time, I had a little girl that I adored, and when she had been born by this previous marriage, I had sworn that I'd never drink again because of the baby. And I'd pick up that little baby, and I'd say, honey, Mama's never going to drink again. I've got you now. But I did, and that hurt. I just didn't want to do that. So when I married again, they wouldn't let me have my baby, and Mama raised her until her death, and I got her when she was 8 or 9 years old. I'd go over there and visit her. I realize now they did the right thing. I couldn't have taken care of her, and she wouldn't have been the lady that she is today. Today, she was 52 years old 2 or 3 weeks ago. And that, of course, makes me way past 76, going on 80. And I feel like I'm talking about somebody else when I tell you that. Because one of my favorite statements is that I'll be back here and see you when I'm 99. And you know I believe it? I just believe I might do that. Because I like to stay active. Thank God I like to be active in AA. And my life was so rotten and so miserable and always breaking those promises and doing the wrong things and wrecking cars and having the cops stop me. And then they'd say, you poor little thing, we'll drive you home. Park your car, get in the squad car with us, and we'll drive you home. They don't do that today. But they did that with me. I must have been a pathetic-looking creature. I don't know why they did that, but that's just what they did. Or they'd follow me home. And it got worse, and finally, I just couldn't live like that. I had this real estate office, and I just went across the street for a short beer. My real estate office was at 77th and Figueroa at that time, which was a pretty good neighborhood, and I made money in the real estate business. I really enjoyed it, and times were good. But I would go across to that bar and just get a short beer so that I could close a deal and go down to escrow, and I wouldn't be seen for 3 days. Because I'd get in my car and I'd drive up to San Francisco and look around at this strange town. I didn't know a soul in it. It would be just getting daylight. And here I had driven over the ridge route, which was just practically a muddy trail in those days, going up through Bakersfield and Fresno and everything. And the sorrow that I felt when I would know that there was Mama there with the baby, and here I am drunk and I'm in San Francisco and I've broken another promise and I'm married to a good guy now. And his family's great, and I'm doing the same thing regardless. Money had nothing to do with it after all. And I just hated myself. I absolutely despised myself, and I couldn't bear it. And when I woke up in that Turkish bath, finally, having been gone up on one of those little trips up to Frisco and back, and I picked up a hitchhiker on the ridge route and let him drive because I couldn't. He turned out to be a nice man. People weren't so mean in those days. He was a nice fellow, just broke and needed a ride. And I got in the back seat and I slept all the way to Los Angeles. And then he shook me and woke me up. And he said, lady, we're in Los Angeles. Here's where I'm leaving you. I'm heading for Skid Row. And I gave him a $5 bill and I never saw him again. And I looked and I was parked right there in front of that Sultan Turkish Baths, famous Sultan Turkish Baths. And I thought, it's a long process to get sobered up. and take the steam bath and get the sarge and everything and get in shape to go home and tell a good lie to cover this and get my foot in the door one more time. So I bought a magazine just to kill time. I couldn't bear my own thoughts. So I didn't care what magazine it was. The newsstand was right there in front of the place, so I just picked it up, paid for it, and took it down there. Later on, when I was feeling a little better, I picked up that magazine, and it was a Saturday Evening Post, quite by accident. And it was dated March 1st, 1941. And on the cover it said, Alcoholics Anonymous by Jack Alexander. God, I wish I had one of those. I don't think you can buy one or steal one. I've tried. I'd steal one if I could, but they're just not available. And for once in my life, I followed through. I rang the bell for the attendant there at the Turkish bath and asked for pen, paper, stamp, envelope. You have to have all four to get a letter written, and I never did have all four, so I never did get any letters written or mail. And I had all the proper ingredients there, and I wrote a very short note back to the address given in the Saturday Evening Post. It's at the very end, I turned to the end. It said, if you need help with a drinking problem, write to box so-and-so, Grand Central Station, New York. And I said, I'm a desperate woman drunk, and I don't want to behave like this. And I've read your article in the Saturday Evening Post. Please help me. And I went on home. I don't remember those details. I didn't think I would have to remember anything about that. It was so gruesome. But in a short time, I got an answer. And it was by Ruth Hawk, our founder's secretary, Bill Wilson's secretary. And it was a short letter saying, you don't have to come back to New York to find Alcoholics Anonymous, because AA started in California December the 19th, 1939. And they started with four men in the general hospital, and they grew to six, and they fell back to four, and then eight, and they've had a hard time of it. We're still in touch with them, and there may be as many as 10 or 12 by now, but I don't know. I do know they meet at 2200 West 7th Street every Friday night at 8:30, so go down and see them. And I was frightened, and I was scared, because I didn't know what they did. I have pictures of possibly they were a bunch of doctors, and that you would go in just like you'd go in a doctor's office, and you'd go in, and they'd say, how much do you drink? Well, I drink every day. Well, what do you drink? Anything I can get. And I thought I'd be interviewed or something, and I wanted very much to pass, you know, and get accepted. And I didn't know what it would cost or anything, because the article that I read, I really didn't understand it. I was too bleary. I just had heard of AA in 1939 when a short article came out in Liberty Magazine called Alcoholics and God. And I thought, isn't that great? I'm going to keep this magazine and write them. But I didn't. And I lost my chance, I thought, because I didn't know where to find them. So 2 years later, when I took this Turkish bath and found that Saturday Evening Post with this article in it by Jack Alexander, I thought, do something this time. You may never have another chance. And so I did, and my letter was answered so speedily by Ruth Hawk, whom I got to meet, and a lot of you did, when she was out here 3 or 4 years ago. She talked at the Windsor Club in Glendale a couple of times. Charming lady, beautiful. And she talked in Orange County. I loved her to death to see that person that I wrote about my drinking problem. It meant so much to me to see her in the flesh. And we correspond, talk on the phone occasionally to this day. And I'm so grateful to her. Because she told me where to go. She said there are just a few men. They've never had a woman alcoholic. And to tell you the truth, we've had very little success with women alcoholics here in New York. But we have one now. And we think she's going to stay. Her name is Marty Mann, and she's been sober 9 months. And so I thought, well, gee whiz, there's a lady there by the name of Marty on the East Coast, and now then, if I can do it too, well, that would be great. It was just as valuable to me as if she just said, we have 300 or 20 or something like that. It gave me hope. And so when she told me where to go, my non-alcoholic husband from this fine family, and he'd never had a short beer in his life, and he was getting ready to leave me, divorce me, and get custody of my little girl, and I knew he was going to do that, and I couldn't bear it. He drove me down there. And we got into this huge lobby, which is almost as big as this room, and then someone said, oh, the AAs, they meet in this little room over here, in a little dining room, around a dining room table. and they directed me in there, and I didn't look at them. I couldn't. My eyes were bloodshot, and I had this red turban on, and I just looked down, and I just couldn't bear to look up at them at all. They were all so well-dressed, and I thought they were doctors, and I just couldn't speak, and I just made myself invisible. And eventually a man got up there, and he started right out by saying, "This is the regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in California. We're a band of ex-drunks who gathered together to obtain and maintain our sobriety on an all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever." And I thought, oh, what an order. I can't go through with that. And I thought immediately, I can't do it. I can't sign that, whatever. I thought they'd pass something around that said that, and that you'd have to sign it, and that this thing that would be, that would say that, you know, we are here on an all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever. Furthermore, we will never drink again. And then I thought you had to sign something like that. And I got kind of mad, and I thought, they can't make me sign anything. I'll die first. And then he added, "But as is our regular custom, before the meeting starts, the women will have to leave." So I looked around the table, and I was the only woman. And my mind told me in 10 seconds a whole big story. I figured it out that this man said to that man before the meeting started, "Now look, there's some dame sitting down here with bloodshot eyes and that thing on her head, kind of pudgy and her cheeks swollen. She looks like a woman drunk. We don't need her. So when you lead the meeting tonight, Joe," or whatever his name was, "you be sure and put something in there about the women, and we'll get rid of her. I don't care what you say, but get rid of her." So when he said, "Before the regular meeting starts, the women will have to leave," I thought they meant me. I thought, they're throwing me out. That's what they're doing. And I got up and put my hands over my face, crying, and went out in the lobby. And there were 3 or 4 comfortable wives sitting out there knitting. Had I known it, they came every week, or sometimes they didn't. But they were the non-alcoholic wives of those few members, and they made this announcement every week. No Al-Anon or any place to meet while the alcoholics met. And they just waited out in the lobby and knitted and talked about their husbands, I guess. They didn't have any program, you know, at that time. So I was just wringing my hands and having fits, wondering what was going on in there. And eventually the doors opened and they came out, and I rushed over to Dick and I said, "Well, give me my pills. Did those doctors give you a prescription or something for me?" He said, "Sib, they don't know you're alive. All they did was brag. All they did was top each other with drunken stories about where they drank and how much they drank and how many jails and prisons that they had been in. And they all kept looking at me for some strange reason. And they thought the poor guy was the alcoholic and that I was the non-alcoholic." I had hysterics, and I went home, and I got out of that car. And when he got out, I just jumped back in, turned the motor on, and ran off. I was just in hysterics. My last chance was gone, and I headed to the neighborhood bar. And I got drunker than anybody ever got drunk, and then I remembered that I had that letter of Ruth Hawks that she had sent me in my purse, because I had rehearsed a little speech. I was going to go down there to this mother group, and I was going to march up to the head man and present this letter from headquarters in New York and say, "Here, sir, is my letter of authorization from the Home Office in New York, which should entitle me to all the privileges of your club." I was going to say something nice like that. But I didn't get a chance when I thought they threw me out. But now I'm good and drunk, and I remember the letter, and it's in my purse. So at the bottom, it said, "P.S., if you need help right away, call Cliff Walker. His number is Crestview, something or other." He lived in Beverly Hills at the time. So I put a nickel in a payphone out there, and I had remembered that article in the Saturday Evening Post. It showed them putting this man in the ambulance, which in my drunken mind, I could envision it as if it was real. I thought that it was a gleaming white ambulance with 2 huge red A's on the side saying AA, and that it would pull up in front of the bars at 2 o'clock and get any falling down drunks and break them in there and take them over to the hospital and get them fixed up. And that's what I thought it meant. I hadn't read that article much, as you can see. And I put this nickel in the telephone, and poor Cliff, milkman, supposed to be at work, he was leaving the house to peddle milk at that time, and I said, "Send your AA ambulance and pick me up right away." He said, "You're drunk." I said, "Of course. Or I wouldn't be calling you. That's why I need the AA ambulance." And he said, "We don't do that." I said, "You don't do that? Well, what's going to happen to me?" He said, "What's going to happen to you is you'll get sober and come to our meeting Friday. We have a meeting once a week down at 2200 West 7th. I can't be there. I'm a milkman, but I have a meeting in my home on Sunday afternoons at 2 o'clock. I work nights. I can't go right now. But you be there, and I'll call them and tell them that you're coming down, and you'll be most welcome." Well, I don't know why I went down, because my mind was just so changeable, and I could have been so drunk, I could have been in Alaska or anywhere, but I did go. And my non-alcoholic husband went down there with me, and I was so frightened that I brought blood to the palms of my hand, that my fingernails were digging in there. I was just so taut, so nervous, so scared, so frightened. And my lip just kept twitching, and that embarrassed me, and the tears would pop in my eyes because I wanted my lip to quit doing that. And I, even when I think about it, it would do it, you know. And I knew people could see that. And I was just humiliated. And I didn't know what to do. And so when we sat in there with these few men, and then they said the women would have to leave, I went out there and wrung my hands and cried, and just was terrible. Well, of course, it turned out they meant the non-alcoholics, and they hadn't meant to harm me in any way, but I didn't know that until I was told when I called up mad. And they said, "Come back next week. We'll be so glad to have a woman alcoholic. We've never had one, and we need you." And I thought, "Need me for what?" And I said, "Well, I do type very well. You know, I'm a secretary." "No," they said, "come on down. You'll be welcome. We just didn't know. It's a terrible mistake. We're sorry you were down there last week and were treated like that, but no one meant any harm, so come back." So the following week, out of curiosity, my big, fat, 300-pound brother, Tex Adams, went down with me. He said, "Just out of curiosity to see where the money is. They got a money-making scheme going down there, and I'll be the first to detect it, and I can get in on some of that gravy." He said, "I'm a social drinker, Sib. You're the drunk." He said, and I looked at him, and I thought, "My gosh, I bailed you out of Lincoln Heights jail 89 times, which I had." So he went down there with me. And I was so scared and nervous, I didn't know what to do. And then this eloquent man got up and talked, and I didn't hear one word. Frank Randall, he turned out to be one of my sponsors because they had no women, and Cliff Walker later on. And he just talked the most beautiful speech that you ever heard. Later I got to really hear it, and it would sink in, but not that night, because I didn't know what they were going to do with me. And I was just so nervous, I just couldn't imagine what would happen. And evidently Cliff had called, because Frank, when he finished making his talk, the group didn't participate. Oh, no. Frank and Mort talked for 2 years. That's the way it was. At the mother group, Frank and Mort were the speakers, and we sat. It was like a school. And it really was most enjoyable. That's what we had, and we didn't know any better. But that was soon rectified when my brother Tex started. He started the hole in the ground the following week. He said, "I'm not going to wait till Friday. I live halfway down to Long Beach, and we've been meeting in a home down there at Curly O'Neill's on Wednesday, so why don't I start a group at the halfway point? I'm going to rent a hall and get a few drunks out here in Southgate and Huntington Park to go on, say, a Tuesday or a Thursday, and then go down to the mother group on Friday." So we went back down there on that Friday, and they had heard about it. And we had no traditions, you know, nothing to guide us. It was just they were frightened and wanted to keep the program intact and not have someone come along and ruin it. And so when we came in and they had heard that he had rented a hall and had started the hole in the ground, they marched right up to him and said, "You're just not grateful to the group that gave you your life and your sobriety back, and you have to go start a rival group, and we don't want you. We formed a little caucus over here. They hadn't gotten to the point of having a committee. We'd gotten together, four or five of us, and we talked about this thing. You go back out there to the hole in the ground and stay away from down here. We don't want you. Now, to make sure that you do that, we've had Pete over here incorporate Alcoholics Anonymous in California. And that means that nobody can start a group unless they clear it through us. And Tex laughed, and he said, "You're joking. You've incorporated AA. I'll lay you 8 to 5. We'll have 20 or 30 groups here within the next 6 months." And, of course, he was right. But I was still going, and I was still scared, and I still didn't talk, and I didn't for a long time, except finally one night at the participation meeting of Texas. He said, "Sib, honey, I used to rock you to sleep. I'm 10 years older than you, and I know you. You're a stubborn woman." And he said, "You'll stay sober just because you're so stubborn. But you're not going to enjoy any of the benefits of this program unless you participate in a participation meeting or speak at a speaker meeting or do the whole thing." And so next Friday night at the hole in the ground, or next Wednesday night, whatever night it was, I am going to call on you first so you won't sit there and sweat it out. And I want you to get up there, and I don't care if you fall down or cry or have hysterics. I don't care what you do. But you're going to get up there in front. And he says, "If you can't think of anything to say, just give them a weather report." He said, "They'll be so glad to see you making the effort that you'll be surprised. So I'm going to call on you first." And I said, "Oh, please, please don't do that, Tex, please." He said, "I'm going to do it." And he did. So when he opened the meeting, he said, "The first person we're going to hear from tonight is my sister, Sib. Come on up here, Sib. Tell us how you're staying sober." And, oh, I do believe that was the worst time of my entire life. I got up there, the tears in my eyes, then my lip jerking. And I probably had on a dress that was too long, because in those days, if they were wearing them short, I was always one style behind. If they were wearing them long, mine was short. And vice versa, I had lost the power to care about how my dresses looked. And so I got up there, and I stammered, and the tears came in my eyes, and my voice shook, and it was the most horrible experience of my life. It didn't take long. I have no idea what I said. I had typed out one paragraph out of the book, and I read it. I just read it. And I could hear the paper crackle, and it just embarrassed me so horribly. So when I sat down in that little group, they began to applaud, and they kept it up. They knew my problem. They knew it well. And the applause kept up. Somebody put a cigarette in my mouth, so I folded my arms and puffed away on the cigarette, and I thought, "My God, was I really that good?" And then my mind wandered off, and I never heard another word the rest of the evening. I thought, now Friday night, down at the mother group, if they ask me to talk, I'm going to do it, because they really thought I was great here tonight. They really didn't think that. They were just glad that I got up there and made the effort. And so it began. I was great reluctance, now and then. Then finally, Frank Randall, my sponsor, he and Cliff were, as I told you, started a group. And Frank picked me up every Monday night, and we went out to the Frank Randall group. And he had me talk a few minutes out there. This was something I had to work on. That if I was going to the meeting that night and Frank said he wanted me to say something for 5 minutes, I'd agonize all day. I would suffer terribly. I just couldn't bear it. And I'd be so relieved when it was over. And finally, somebody asked me here a few years ago, "Sib, how long did it take before you could get up and talk?" And I said, "Oh, let me think about that. I can't remember exactly, but I believe it was either 10 or 20 years. And I think it was. And so it gets easier when you do it. You look out there, and you see your friends sitting there, like Matt and Marilyn, and they're smiling at me, and I know they love me, and Chuck and Elsa and Clancy, and it's his birthday, and Rick and all of you, you know. And I know that if I got up here and just didn't say too much. We've heard such good stuff here tonight from those first two speakers. They were the best 2 10-minute speakers I've heard in a very long time. I could have listened to them and been so terribly happy if they had talked, and then if our dear Chuck could have gotten up here instead of me, I would have been in seventh heaven. It would have been a tremendous birthday for Clancy. Truly would have. But as the years went by, bad things began to happen. And this was something I had such utter faith in AA. I thought, now I'm sober, life will be beautiful forever. Nothing bad can ever happen because I'm in AA. I've always been able to work, always had a good job, and now I'm sober and nothing bad can happen. I don't have to have any money worries or anything bad at all, ever. And that's not so. Because bad things happen to human beings whether they drink or not. And that was such a shock to me, to find out that rough times can come along. And, you know, the roughest time I had was when my brother Tex died right there at the hole in the ground just before the meeting started. And they went over to shut the door up and said, we're going to close the group for a week out of respect to Tex. And I said, you're not going to do that. If you haven't got the guts to lead the meeting, I'll do it. This door has never been closed on a meeting night. No meeting ever closes for any reason. And if you don't want to lead it, I will. And I did. And I shouldn't have, maybe. But that's what I did. And I couldn't cry. And that was a thing I'd forgotten how to do, and I didn't know I was in pain. I don't know why I reacted that way. Maybe it was because Papa had died 6 weeks before. And so there were two deaths in the family there, and I went along just trudging back and forth and doing what I was supposed to, not thinking about drinking, but I guess I was just miserable for a long, long time and didn't really realize it. Things do happen. Now, I had a boxing and wrestling arena down in Orange County called the OCAC, Orange County Athletic Club. And back in that era, just before TV, 3 or 4 years before TV, I got it. We made a lot of money. Tex managed it for me. And we had boxing on Tuesdays and wrestling on Thursdays. And we had a concession there. We had boys going up in the balcony and everywhere and selling cases of pop and stuff like that. And so that was great. I mean, we made a lot of money. And then you know what happened when TV came in? Everybody stayed home and looked at boxing and wrestling on that marvelous box of TV. And we watched that crowd dwindle down and dwindle down and dwindle down. And I was stubborn and I wouldn't close it up. And yet the nut was the same. You had those expenses that you had to pay for the ushers and for the concession just the same. And I wouldn't do it until I lost everything I had. And I finally locked the door up and threw the key away and went out and got a job. And that hurt, but I did it. And I lost that big house that I lived in and the housekeeper and everything, and I wound up in a housekeeping room down on West Adams near Figueroa. And I remember how lonely I was. I was so terribly lonely. The reason that I was down there alone, I was married to this marvelous alcoholic who had adopted my daughter, Addie. And I had come home from a meeting one night at the hole in the ground, and he met me at the door, and he'd been grumpy for a long time. He would sit there and play martyr. And when I would get dressed to go to a meeting, he'd say, again? I say, oh, honey, I realize I've been going to a lot of meetings, but I'll cut back. I promise I'll just go on Fridays. Just the same thing I used to tell him about drinking. Oh, honey, I won't do it anymore. Please forgive me. And I was giving him that line about AA, and he wanted me to quit AA. And he'd never had a drink in his life, and he thought I'd go there and get fixed in a week or two and be a good wife and mother. And I'd beg him to go with me, but he wouldn't do it. And he would go to the Christmas parties, perhaps, and shake hands stiffly and stand back in a corner and be miserable. And so one night I came home from a meeting, and he was standing there smiling, just a broad smile. He said, honey, come in. I've got the solution to our marriage. So I went into the living room of this beautiful home that we had, and I said, tell me quickly, what do you mean you've got the solution to our marriage? He says, well, I've been thinking about it. Now, he said, listen to this. I want you to go back to drinking like you did in the good old days, and I'll take care of you. He said, it wasn't so bad compared to this. And I stood there, and I looked at him. I didn't have a tantrum. I didn't throw anything, as I did many times, throw dishes when I lose my temper or something. I didn't cry, and I didn't rant and rave. I said nothing, because I was stunned. I hardly recall what followed. He probably went upstairs and went to bed. All I know is I picked up my purse. I still had my coat on. I went outside. There was my car, brand new car, and I stood and looked at it longingly. I had the keys in my hand, and I laid them back on the porch. And I walked down to the corner, and I got a bus. And I got off down around West Adams and Figueroa, and I rented a room with a bathroom down the hall. And then I went down to the Times, and I got a job. and I never looked back. A wonderful man, wonderful father to my daughter, Addie. She's a dear, sweet lady now that enjoys AA so much. She's been sober two, three years up in Hollister, in a little town there. Beautiful lady. She was down to see me recently. But my God, that was so hard for me because I lived about two blocks from the church there, the Dahini church where those bells and chimes would go at certain times, and I'd wake up in that mean little room and getting ready to go to work, and I'd hear those bells ringing, and they were so sad to hear under those circumstances, and I could hardly bear it, and sometimes I'd cry on the bus going down to work at the times, and I'd catch a streetcar or a bus out to the hole in the ground at night. The loneliest period of my life, but I had to do it, and it was just one of those things that I had to do, because I did not want to get drunk, and I couldn't quit AA, and I knew that. And so the painful period was over, as happens. You know, these things happen in every AA's life sooner or later. Not that thing that I just told you, but something. Money, or property, or marriages, or love affairs, or just bad things that happen to normal human beings, neighbors of yours down the street. But I found out that Alcoholics Anonymous would work under all circumstances. And that was the big payoff. And then I knew that if it worked under all circumstances, great. That it wouldn't be worth a plugged nickel to me if it only worked for me on Christmas or Thanksgiving or in the spring or maybe in the fall. And drinking in between. Yeah, AA works. Life can get a little tough, but all you need to do is get on the phone. And thank God that's what I used to do. And I would talk to people. Not at first, because I didn't want them to know. It was hard for me to do. But finally I opened up a little bit. And more to where now today. And I've called Clancy, crying. Clancy, a terrible thing has happened. Well, what is it, Sybil? What is it? And I'll tell him, and then he'll make it seem small, and I'll laugh and hang up. It all takes about 60 seconds. With Clancy, you don't get an hour and a half. You just tell him what's wrong, and he gives you the answer, and that's good. And I know I can always do that with Clancy. I love him. I always have and always will. He's just the greatest guy. I know that when I'm in trouble, I can call him. He's never failed me. I'm not always in trouble. I don't bother him much. But if it's something that I can't handle or that I can't think through clearly, I know that he can think a little more clearly in a crisis than I can. And so I call him my telephone sponsor. He doesn't know that, and it can't hurt him any, and it helps me a lot. So that's okay. But anyway, today I'm married to an alcoholic who spoke to you last week, Bob. And I want to tell you that he's an interesting man to be with. He gets up singing at 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm not human until noon, but that's okay. Since his heart attack 3.5 years ago, he's taken over my kitchen. I'll be there and he'll say, "Stand back, please." And, he's got a recipe book and he likes to try out things to cook. And you know, he's an awfully good cook. And he tries things out and cooks them and he'll do the dishes and he spends a lot. I'm getting a little jealous of my kitchen, to tell you the truth. However, he's a great guy. There's not a dull moment. He doesn't sit around and just read a newspaper, I'll tell you that. He loves AA. He's on the phone all the time with members. He goes every moment that he can, that he's able to go physically. And I believe that he would sleep at an AA meeting hall if he could. He loves it so much. One of his favorite sayings is that he's having a love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I truly believe it, because that's just the way it is with him. And so am I. And AA has not changed. It's here and will always be here. And we're growing in greater numbers, and younger people are coming in, and they don't have to wait until they're 35, 40, 50, or 60 years old. They're coming in like that young lady sitting right there, and they're catching on to this thing. And one of these days I'll go to a meeting, and I'm sure I will, and I'll hear some youngster who came in the early teens say, "My name is Susie, and I've been sober 59 years. And it'll happen. Because AA is here to stay. And it's such a joy for me to go to a meeting and see new people raise their hands and then go back the next week and there they are again. I wait for my phone to ring. I told you this the last time that I was here. And I got some results. Now, I know that Chuck and Elsa get thousands of calls. For some reason or other, people, not too many, call me. And I begged for phone calls last time, and I got some results. Two call me up from this group. But I am home all day, so is Bob. And one more time, I'll say that our number is 222-9907. It's in the phone book under Sybil Corwin and another place under Bob Corwin. And the only thing that we ask is that you phone and don't drop in. Because if you just drop in, you're going to find a very untidy house. I don't have time to do too much housework. I never liked it in the first place. And I use AA as an excuse. But if I have just cleaned the house, it's the cleanest house you ever saw, and then I'll say, now, Bob, look what you did there. You see that dish? I just cleared this table off, and you've already put a dish on it. And, you know, and, oh, I'm real bossy then because the house is real clean. But never mind. We have 5 cats and 2 dogs. There's the 2 little kitties in the bathroom. Now, Bob found them on the steps last week. They were just born. Matt was responsible for that, I think. He was coming to see us. Well, you were there. And the little kitties, Bob picked them up and said, oh, Sib, let me put them in the bathroom, and we'll find a home for them. Oh, the poor little things. We can't go down and put them to sleep. Come on, kitty, kitty, kitty. And so he put them in the bathroom, and they're not any longer than that now, and they're learning how to meow. And they eat like horses, and I walk in there, and you have to walk very carefully, or you're going to step on a little kitty cat. And then we have a porch cat who comes there to be fed and then walks off in a dignified fashion, won't have a thing to do with us. I don't know why we bother to feed him. And then we have Brother, that I often make a little talk to Brother, and I'll say, Brother, if a man knocked at the door today and asked for you and said he would buy you and give me $100,000, I'd say, man, go away, you can't have my cat. Bob says, just let that man come to the door when I'm here. And then we have Claus, who really has claws. He's a black one. And we only have 2 dogs now because the others died of old age. So we're down to 2 dogs and 5 cats, and that's quite a family, really and truly. It's a very different sort of life, 2 alcoholics living together, staying sober and talking about AA and reading about it and having as many friends as we have. And you don't have to stay lonely. You can call people. You don't have to sit there and feel sorry for yourself like I do sometimes, waiting, nobody's called me today. And, you know, AA is more than just a way of life. It is a way of life. I don't find it too difficult to stay sober. Of course, you say, well, I guess not. I'll have 44 years in March. 44 years sounds to you young people a lifetime. And AA and our steps have not changed. We've had traditions, thank God, because we bungled along without them for many years and made the most terrible mistakes. You can't imagine how many mistakes that we made. But fortunately, that's why our traditions were born. They were born out of the mistakes that we made in the earlier days. So I know that from 41 to this year and this hour and this day and this month seems like an unreasonable amount of time. And many of you would say, well, she could resign now and never take another drink. No. If a really bad thing happens and I start shaking or I get upset, a tragedy would come along. Who's to say? I don't know. I'm not going to take that chance. I'm not afraid of drinking. I don't think about drinking, but I do know that I have witnessed other people who left AA for X periods of time. I won't name any amounts, a long time, and eventually got away from their way of life and being in contact with their AA friends and wound up drunk and died. And I don't want to do that, and I'm not coming because I'm afraid I'd die and get drunk. You couldn't keep me away. If I never spoke to this specific group again, as long as I live, I'll be back, because I know I'll be welcome. And I want to thank everybody that thought about having me here tonight. I love every one of you, and I mean it. This is the greatest life on earth to be one of you. Thank you for letting me talk.